Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here at the Tattered Cover. And I really appreciate the fact that you've come out on this very bitter night. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a little bit from Tatiana, and then I'll talk as little as possible. And then what I really look forward to are your questions, because your you will provide the spark. I rely, like Blanche DuBois, on the kindness of strangers, or at least their questions. So I'll move as briskly as I can to that, and I do enjoy it. So please participate by making my life difficult. So let me tell you a little bit about Tatiana, just to set the stage for what I'm going to read, which are really sort of three stages in Arkady's relationship with Tatiana, this journalist. I should explain that the main character, Tatiana, is a journalist, a somewhat fearless journalist, someone who has covered things like the slaughter of the children at Breslan, murder of the hostages at the Nord Theater in Moscow, and other events like that. So she never accepts the official version, because the official version is so widely not the facts. So I'll start with a little bit about Arkady, a touch of Zhenya, the teenage boy who makes his life difficult. Oh, that's par for the course, I've discovered. And his sidekick, Detective Sergeant Victor Orlov. There's a description of Orlov that even I appreciate, which was that he was an alcoholic. If he was busy, he needed to be busy, because if he was, as long as he was busy, he was like a hoop that would stay up as long as it was rolling. I could have said that better, but we begin with his sometimes roommate, Anya. Anya made a terrible nurse. When she tried to cook, Arkady smelled food burning and heard her swearing at pots and pans. When she wrote in his apartment, he smelled her cigarettes and listened to her swear at her laptop. But he was surprised by Anya's patience. He would have expected her, like a cat, to move on, although she had assignments, a fashion shoot, a photo essay on the mafia. She dropped in several times a day to see how he was. "You'd miss me if I didn't. You're a secret romantic," she said. "I'm a cynic," he said. "I believe in car wrecks, airline disasters, missing children, self-immolation, suffocation with pillows." "What is it you don't believe in?" "I don't believe in saints," he said. "They get people killed." "It's no big deal," Victor said when he visited. "Seems to me that you're making a lot of fuss for a couple of busted ribs. What the devil is the matter with you anyway?" "Punctured lung," Arkady said. "A couple of days with the valve in his chest and the lung would reinflate on its own." Victor said, "It's like visiting Our Lady of the Camellias." "Do you mind?" Victor held up a pack of cigarettes. For once, Arkady didn't crave one. "So it's suicide," Victor said. "Or murder," Arkady said. "No," Victor said, "I heard it on the radio. The prosecutor determined that Tatiana Petrovna threw herself out her window. They say she was depressed." "Of course she was depressed. Who isn't depressed? Anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear is depressed. The planet is depressed. That's what global warming is." Arkady wished he had such insights. His mind was hung up on details. What are the neighbors? Who heard her screams? Screaming what? Arkady felt painkillers lift him up to a dull euphoria. He could tell Zhenya had stopped by because a large chocolate chess piece wrapped in a bow sat on his nightstand. Arkady was a light sleeper, but Zhenya was as elusive as a snow leopard. A man confined to a few rooms becomes a meteorologist. Through the window pane, he charts clouds, tracks the stately passing of a thunderhead, notices the first streaks of rain. The bedroom wall becomes a screen in which he projects, what if? What if he had saved this woman, or been saved? A person in this situation welcomes the clash and bang of a storm. Anything to interrupt a review of his life. Arkady Kirillovich Renko, senior investigator for very important cases, member of the Young Pioneers and a generation of gilded youth, and as luck would have it, an expert in self-destruction. His father, a military man, blew his head off. His mother, more genteel, weighted herself with stones and drowned. Arkady had dabbled in the act himself, but been distracted at a critical moment, and with that his suicide fever had passed. Still, with all his experience and expertise, he considered himself a fair judge of suicide. He defended the honor of people who killed themselves, the commitment that suicide demanded, the isolation and sweat, the willingness to follow through and open a second bottle of sleeping pills, or make a deeper slice across the wrist. They had earned the title, and he was offended by the imposture of murder as something it was not. Tatiana Petrovna would no more have killed herself and flown to the moon. When the tube was removed from Arkady's chest, the doctor had said, We will put on a clean bandage every day and tape you up. The hole will heal itself. Your ribs will heal too, if you let them. No twisting, lifting, cigarettes, or sudden moves. Think of yourself as a broken cup. I do, Arkady said. Arkady's apartment was a battlement against the storm. Sometimes it sounded as if nature was laying siege against the city, as if black furies and Irish banshees were tearing up and down the streets. It was 2 a.m, and he was wide awake. For dinner, he had eaten something greasy with bread and vodka. It occurred to him that quite possibly this might be his last case, that he might close his so-called career chasing the anonymous dead, which served him right. He picked up a shoebox of audio cassettes he had taken from Tatiana Petrovna's apartment and fed one into his own recorder. What, he wondered, did a saint sound like? He pushed play, and a woman's voice said, "The bastards won't let me through. They did before. This time they won't. There are more than 300 children in the school, and this is the second day of the siege. I've brought food and medical supplies and the chance to negotiate. The Kremlin doesn't want negotiations. In fact, snipers have been ordered further back from the school, further away from any communication. It's not as if they have any plan apart from no negotiation with terrorists. If not negotiations, what? Without negotiations, there will be a slaughter of horrific dimensions. But is anyone from the Kremlin here? The Chechen leaders are no better. They could intercede with their brothers in the building. Instead, they remain silent. They all remain silent as the slaughter of 300 children draws closer." By the end of the tape, his throat was constricted, and he discovered that his face was wet with tears. An unlit, forgotten cigarette was still in his hand. He screwed the cap back in the vodka bottle and tried another tape. How does a man know when he becomes obsessive? Who can tell him except a friend? More specifically, how could two men like him and his detective, Victor, thank you. See, this is my wife, and she's had to type this whole damn thing. And so she's not going to let anything get by me or get by any of us. And I appreciate it. More specifically, how could two men like him and Victor cover one city, let alone two cities, hundreds of miles apart? He would need a dozen detectives and police dogs, none of which the prosecutor would authorize. All the prosecutor would authorize was a game of mutual musical chairs in the morgue. At this point, if Tatiana had been moved from drawer to drawer in the morgue, she would be a light blue with a film of crystals. Perhaps the person hiding her was waiting for the first mantle of snow to lay her down properly, when outrage was spent and she was just one saint out of many. The strange thing was, Arkady looked forward to listening to the other tapes, not because Tatiana's voice was especially mellifluous, but because it was clear, and not because the events she described were dramatic, but because she underplayed her part, and because listening to the tapes he thought he knew her and that they had met before. Was that obsessive? A poet wrote, "The moon will float up in the sky, dropping the oars into the water. As ever, Russia will get by and dance and weep in every quarter." "So nothing changes," Tatiana said on the tape. "The poet Yesenin knew it 100 years ago. Russia is a drunken bear, sometimes an entertainment, sometimes a threat, often a genius, but as night falls, always a drunken bear curled up in the corner. Sometimes, in another corner, lies a journalist whose arms and hands have been systematically broken. The thugs who do such work are meticulous. We don't have to go to Chechnya to find such men. We recruit them and train them and call them patriots. And when they find an honest journalist, they let the bear loose." Is it worth it? The problem with the martyrdom is the waiting. Sooner or later, I will be poisoned, or nudged off a cliff, or shot by a stranger. But first, I will put a torpedo under their waterline, so to speak. Also, why does heaven seem so dull? There's love in heaven, but is there passion? Do we really have to go barefoot and wear those robes? Are we allowed high heels? I've always envied women in high heels. I would like to spend my first 1,000 years in heaven learning to tango in high heels. In the meantime, I'll stay ahead of the bear as long as I can. It wasn't so much that he was listening to her, as more a sense of being alone with her. And if they were alone, he would have been so bold as to offer her a cigarette. Well, I don't know if it comes through to you, but I really enjoyed writing this book. It allowed me to do things, to create another version of Anna Politkovskaya, who was the journalist who inspired this book. I've given her some changes, and I'm not pretending to say that this is Politkovskaya, but I am saying that that she should not be forgotten, that we should not be the silent pallbearers to someone who was so singular, someone who lived on the edge, who took the chance for all Russians over many years. And so we have that. And then, of course, we've got Arkady, who is, well, he calls himself a cynic, and he is painfully not that. But he is harder than he used to be. It's a strange thing to write a book in which, and write a series of books, 8 books now, in which you have a character who is alive enough to change and become harder in some aspects and then very much softer in some others. And then I've got these other characters like Zhenya, who's a chess prodigy and a real pain. And my son came up to me and said, "I'm not Jenny, am I?" And I said, "No." So we sort of move as a character now. I don't walk alone anymore. Every step I take, I can hear another dozen steps behind me of all these characters, not to mention the characters from other sort of standalone books. I've been very fortunate in that the publishers have been very accommodating to my desire to write different kinds of books. And it just affords me to do books like Rose, which I see heads nodding. I always love that because it was such a strange book, one of about pit-brow girls in Victorian England, which is about as far as you can get from an investigator in Moscow. But I've talked a little bit, and I've already informed some people in the audience that I am relying on them to come forward with some good questions. to throw me off my stride, so to speak, if you could possibly call this a stride. I should also say that one other thing that was different with this book was that I could not write it. My Parkinson's disease had gotten to a pace and a downward spiral that I could no longer type. And I had to undergo a regimen, a bit of surgery called deep brain stimulation, which saved me halfway in that it allowed me to continue writing. But I could not, I didn't have the hands, but I did have the woman who was willing to step in and let me dictate. And a wife who was allowing it, her husband to dictate 9 hours a day, you can't imagine what a prize that is. So, anyway, with all these things in mind, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes?
Since you went back to Rose, how did you get started with Stallion Gate?
The question was, after having gotten as far as Rose, how did I get the idea of writing Stallion Gate, which was about the making of the A-bomb. And I always wanted to write I'd written some other books about set in New Mexico. That I was determined to do so, to write a truly New Mexican book, because my mother was Pueblo Indian, and I had a great many. My grandmother had 21 children, which, you know, I don't know if there's a... I've never checked in that. Guinness Book of World Records. It would be chilling to actually find my grandmother's name there. But I wanted to write something that was an American book and a, very much a New Mexican book. And also I love the images of a beautiful black San Ildefonso pot and the bomb that was being made a few miles away, and Robert Oppenheimer and the other crew in the Manhattan Project. Yes.
Do you have a sense of your fan base in Russia? Do you have a lot of fan letters?
I don't. I've never received a fan letter, but the kind of fan letter. Oh, the question was: do I ever get any? Fan letters or any reaction from Russia. The reaction was that, you know, if you had possessed a copy of Gorky Park when it was first published, you could you'd be sent away for a couple of years, sent to prison. And there was a period there where I was distinctly not welcome. I was working on a book called Polar Star on a Russian factory ship. The captain of that ship was a very brave, far-sighted man, but very nervously he drew me aside one day. Actually didn't do it until he came and visited me here in the States. He had saved for over all those years a copy of a book that he had been issued when he was coming to Dutch Harbor. And because it was an American port, and this book had a warning to watch out for. I'm going to try my French here. This is going to be exciting. Agent provocateur. So to watch out for them, and at the top of the list was Martin Cruz Smith. So it took a while for me to be acceptable once again. Now I'm on the bookshelf, you know, the paperback shelf. In any newsstand in Moscow, which I'm very happy about, although at the same time it's lost a certain fizz. Yes.
How did you develop your interest and insight into Russian people?
The question is, how could I develop my insight into the psyche of the Russian people? And I think because it's possible, because the key to it, in large part, is humor. and humanity and intensity and all the hard stuff, all the Russian stuff that is not very humane is going to force its way into your recognition anyway. But I really enjoyed the difficult part of finding out what they, what they laughed at. I did a piece for the Wall Street Journal, which is pretty remarkable for me. I mean, Martin Cruz Smith and the Wall Street Journal said, together like that, it's sort of an oxymoron. But I did an article for them about Russian humor. And it just starting with Gogol, it's just wonderfully dark, heady mix. And is it for an example, there was a writer named Voinovich who was writing about members of the Writers Union being awarded different hats, winter hats, depending on their eminence. And some are getting sable, and some are getting rabbit, and some are getting marmot. This poor soul is given a tomcat. And the whole book is a rail against this receiving a tomcat. And it's that kind of thing, among others, many other things, that that appeals to me. Yes?
Were you able to get into Kaliningrad? Were you able to travel there? I didn't know that that was open to Westerners.
The question is, was I able to get into Kaliningrad, which was, in fact, a secret city during the Cold War, and still not really a friendly, tourist-friendly place. But I did. I had no trouble really getting in. It's a little laborious process, but you get there, you arrive, and you get out of the plane, and as you walking out of the terminal, you become vaguely aware that the terminal is falling apart. It's been falling apart for 25 years. It's got the city has a huge preeminent structure in it, which is the Communist Party headquarters, which was put in place of what was it called? It was called the Monster, this building, 20 stories high, and it was built in place of the castle of Königsberg, which had been there before it was bombed flat during the war. And so they got this thing, it looks like a headless elephant, and it's sort of a gray-blue, and it's never been used, never been utilized, because they discovered when they started excavating that they were excavating to ancient rivers and channels, and that the whole thing was about to fall down. So it's completely empty, and when Putin came for a visit, a kind of like a state visit, they didn't dare let him in, and they didn't dare make an issue of it. All they could do was paint the whole building blue and then pretend it didn't exist. Everyone from Putin on down pretended there was no huge 20-story headless elephant standing in the middle of the town. It's another version of the tomcat. Another question? Yes. I was last in Russia about a year and a half ago. I was first there in 1973.
I believe I had the privilege and pleasure of hearing you at the Tattered Cover years ago. I don't know when. And I believe at that time you said that you were not able to, you were on a list of people who couldn't get into Russia. Is that correct?
That was true at that point. But since then I've been... When was that?
In years. What year was that?
The question, what years was it? Was I when I was welcome? What years when it was when I wasn't welcome? And I think it was the time when I felt somebody creep up behind me and put their arm, their hand on me. Oh my God! They're there.
I just wanted to offer a refreshment.
I can't give a date. I never expected to write 8 books about Arkady or about Russia. And I was determined not to write another Russian book until I figured out, because I'm such a keen mind, that the fact that I had played the piano once did not mean that I had played every tune that could be found on the keyboard. And so I allowed myself to get involved again. And the second book was Polar Star, and that had too many delicious things in it for me not to do it. You know, there's the scenes, it's like walking out in a buffet. You know, there's so many little strange platters of food. And Polar Star has an ending in it that where I a weaker man I describe to you. Yes.
Where do you get all the mafia characters in Tatiana? I mean, the Chechens and the various personalities. Is that from an experience you've had over there?
Well, I've spent a little bit of time. The question was, of course, thank you. I get signals from all. It's a little bit like giving a talk on an aircraft carrier. You can see somebody way down at the end of the ship is sort of signaling like, drop your wings now, land now. The question was, how did I develop my knowledge of the mafia, the Russian mafia? Well, first I develop a relationship with Russian detectives. And then they lead me to the mafia because they love having almost every Russian detective or cop has a series of relationships with the mafia. Or you find yourself, as my wife and I did, sitting next to a grandfather at an outdoor cafe, and he's very boldly, proudly telling us how his son murdered another. Somebody else the night before at the same table we were sitting at. So, you know, so a lot of that to me is a bonus, but to a wiser person that would also be a signal to go. Yes. That's a touchy subject. The question is, how many books have I written?
Not published, just written. Maybe you never even put
out. Oh, if I write them, I publish them. No, it was really. The question is, how many books have I written? And I don't know. I went to some kind of charity affair where I was introduced as having written over 200 adult westerns. I was off. I was very impressed. Well, they were wrong by about 198. But yeah, I've written quite a few, and stuff that I go back now. I occasionally see one on a rack, and I look at it and I say, "What is he doing? Where's the plot? You know, it's just a mystery to me." And it always says that, you know, it's reassuring in a way. It says that anything you do is not going to be as bad as what you can buy. So that's a kind of it's kind of an indictment, actually. But I've written a great many, most of it pulp, but I was very lucky in finding people who. I don't know, you find people who start supporting you. You find people who are, you know, willing to publish anything you'll do. And that's... And then you find people who were refused it. Like the publisher who had Gorky Park. He was very unhappy that I had written a book with a Russian hero, because I had told him I was going to Moscow to write about an American hero. You know, it's the American hero who always shows the Russians or French or English or whatever how things are really done. And Once I got there, I got a somewhat better idea, which was to do a Russian novel with a Russian character. And I wrote 200 pages and gave it to him, and he gave it right back and said, where's my American hero? I said, well, he's a secondary character, and he's now Gabby Hayes. And actually, he was Arkady. So I tried to get the book back. He wouldn't sell it to me until finally he was fired, which is the fate of anyone who crosses me. Be aware. And so I was able to buy my book back. But in the course of that, over that about 8 years or so, I was constantly writing, constantly publishing terrible books, but all the time working to save Arkady at that point. Yes.
When you're in Russia, what's the feeling that you get from the people there now?
Well, it's a very different feeling. You know, it's not a political feeling anymore. It's an economic feeling, and the question was, what kind of feeling do I get from Russians now? And it certainly has changed. It's gone from a political stature, and when I say stature, I mean there's always a degree of nobility to it, and it's now an economic one. And it's when you're at somebody's party, and it's a party for himself, and he's got a rocket ship, he's got cosmonauts, he's got $8 billion, he's got everything you could possibly do to indulge in one afternoon, and still, of course, you can see that this is not going to be enough. It will never be enough. So that kind of plutocracy is scary. I wish I could speak more knowledge about it, but I never had $11 billion.
We can take one more question, and it should be awesome.
Yes.
Your grandmother has no chance. There's a
Russian. Jesus Christ. Is that a laptop I see on you? Yes. Yeah. I'll have to carry that with me now. That knowledge frees me up in one way, but I'll take one more question. He spends a lot of time in the saddle. Enough said. And one more. Yes.
Is there any other country that bubbles up with interest for you?
Oh, yeah. Does any other country bubble up with interest with me?
What is it?
Is it okay if I write a book about Venice?
Oh.
Okay, there we go. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.